Welcome to I'm a Writer, But my guest today is Katya Apikina. Katya Apikina is a novelist, screenwriter, and translator. Her debut novel, The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, was named a Best Book of the Year internationally by Kirkus, BuzzFeed, Literary Hub, Elle Germany, El País, and others, and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, a semifinalist for the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award, and shortlisted for the Stanford Library's 2020 William Saroyan International Prize for Writing. She translated poetry and prose from Russian for Night Wraps the Sky, Writings by and About Mayakovsky, shortlisted for the Best Translated Book Award. Born in Moscow, she immigrated to the United States when she was 3 years old and currently lives in Los Angeles. Her new novel is Mother Doll, a sharp and visceral nesting doll of a novel about four generations of mothers and daughters and the inherited trauma cast by Russian history. Welcome, Katya. I'm so happy that you're here.
I'm so happy to be here.
I told you this earlier, but I absolutely love your writing. I was so excited to hear that you had a new book out and that you would possibly consider coming on this show. And as I knew I would, I absolutely loved Mother Doll, and I can't wait to hear you read a little bit of it.
Thank you. I think I'm going to read from the beginning of Mother Doll. It was ironic that Zhenya and Ben would come home from spending time with people who had kids and be so giddy with relief and self-righteousness over their decision not to have any that it would make them want to fuck. They had just gotten back from seeing a high school friend of Ben's who was in town to fundraise for the Obama campaign and had brought along his whole family. It was watching this friend try to hold a conversation while also wrangling his toddler and switching off with his tense wife on something ominously called the baby's bedtime routine that made Zhenya and Ben, now in their empty, quiet apartment, feel engorged with smugness. "You can't really go anywhere," Zhenya said, leaning out of the bathroom mid-floss to continue the shit-talking they'd started in the car. "You can't even have a conversation. Having kids makes people so rude. Can you imagine just letting your kids stand in front of your face yelling and interrupting like that?" Ben was naked in bed already, absent-mindedly stroking his nipples. "It's true. What did we even talk about?" He'd ask me about work, and then as soon as I'd start to answer, he would shift his attention to a screaming child, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do in that situation. Like, am I supposed to wait? Am I supposed to answer over the screaming child? Zhenya spat in the sink and dried her mouth with a towel, laughing. "I would have loved to see you yell over that kid like you were in a loud bar or something." When she stepped out of the bathroom, Ben was using the sheet to fan at his erection. "What are you going to do with that mouth?" he said in a funny voice. "I cleaned it just for you." She bared her teeth. They had sex freely with all their fluids sterilized. A strange image appeared to Zhenya right after she came of her grandmother's boiling the drinking water. Vivid and metaphorical, she thought her grandmother could visit her like that only if she were dead. So even though it was late and even later on the East Coast, she called to make sure that her grandmother was still alive. Zhenya thought about that visitation again a few weeks later when she noticed that her period was late. Ben had gotten a vasectomy as soon as the union gave him health insurance, and she had been on the pill for years, so she wasn't really worried. She took a pregnancy test just to confirm what she knew, that pregnancy was impossible, but the test was positive. She'd gotten the first pregnancy test from the dollar store, so she got three more from CVS in case the first one was defective. Why was it so cheap? It must have been wrong, she assured herself as she peed on the more expensive ones in the pharmacy bathroom. It wasn't wrong. She was pregnant. The nausea started almost immediately. That day, during her shift at the hospital where she was working as a translator, she had frozen several times mid-sentence, hand up, eyes closed, waiting for the wave of nausea to pass over her. She knew that she would need to have an abortion. What other option was there? She'd had one before, and unlike in the dramatic way it was portrayed in movies and on TV, it wasn't a difficult choice. She wasn't traumatized afterwards, and no part of her regretted that decision. Yet now, somehow, it did not feel like a possibility at all. Why was that? Ben had always been clear about not wanting children. Forcing a child on someone who didn't want one was barbaric. But hadn't she also been sure that she didn't want one until suddenly she did? She called her grandmother to tell her the news. Her grandmother had stopped being able to outwardly understand things, but it was still possible, Zhenya thought, that she was at least partially in there. Anyway, she was the only person whom Zhenya wanted to tell. She called the house, and her mother answered. Zhenya had been hoping that it would be Nathaniel, her stepdad, because he lacked curiosity and never asked questions. He'd married her mom when Zhenya was 6 years old and was the only father figure Zhenya had ever known, and yet she never thought of him as dad. But he was a reliable presence. He could be counted on to shuffle up the stairs with a cordless phone and hold it to her grandmother's ear and not think anything of it afterwards. Her mother, though, was a different story. Zhenichka, her mother, Marina, was already sighing. What gibberish. Don't use your grandmother's dying body as your confessor. You want to help your grandmother, come back here once in a while and help me take care of her. Change her sheets, brush her hair, massage her legs with lotion so she doesn't get sores. Do something practical for once. Don't whisper bullshit into the phone while I hold it to her unhearing, unseeing, unthinking, but still somehow living head. It's grotesque. Then she hung up. But what did her mother know about what Baba Vera could or couldn't hear? And if her grandmother had been able to speak, she would have surely disdained the practical. She would have wanted exactly what Zhenya was offering, the contents of her heart. A few days later, Zhenya and Ben went out to dinner at the Thai place in the strip mall across the street. She thought she would tell Ben then, but she didn't. She felt instinctually protective of what was growing in her. Telling him, she sensed, would let the air out or in. Wasn't that how Hemingway described an abortion in Hills Like White Elephants? It's an awfully simple operation. Just let the air in. The characters never talked about it directly. She'd read that story in a high school English class after having her first abortion and laughed at the melodrama of it, laughed hysterically enough to be sent out into the hallway. Part of why she couldn't stop laughing was because the boy in her class who'd impregnated her, had thought the story was about a lobotomy. All right, that's where I'll stop.
That's such a great place to start our conversation because something that I love about your writing is how effortlessly funny you are. I mean, you are there's so many laugh out loud moments in what you just read, but there's
Thank
also
you.
really like poignant and sad things happening as well. I want to hear from you what humor, like how the humor comes through as you're writing. Is it something you're consciously doing, or is it just sort of natural for you?
I mean, I was thinking about this, how like humor is also just like a coping mechanism, for reality. And I think definitely it's like a coping mechanism I use for things. And it does like kind of create distance between you and like the thing that is giving you strong emotions. So, that's probably like my coping mechanism for living in life. But, it wasn't something I like consciously was like trying to be funny. And it's funny because actually, like, I remember thinking we moved out to Los Angeles and I was like trying to do screenwriting. And I was like, am I a comedy writer? And like everybody around me was like, no, you definitely are not a comedy writer.
Oh my God.
So I was like, okay.
It's such a different thing, right? Like comedy and screenwriting is like, I don't know, like it's way less subtle maybe than we would be on the page. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems almost like mathematical or something. Like when I think about like those Harvard Lampoon people and like the ability to just like churn out jokes. I mean, yeah, I can't. Like I remember actually in a creative writing class, we had to bring in a joke and tell it. This was like as an undergrad, and it was just so mortifying because like I'm horrible at telling jokes. And it was just like sitting at that table, just like waiting for my turn to come with just like dread. And it was just like a night it was a nightmare. So
Didn't go
yeah,
over well. What joke was it?
oh my God. I just went with like the stupidest joke that was short. That was like my it was like, what's brown and sticky? A stick. That was it. That was so mortifying. It was like I just couldn't do like anything with a long setup or I don't know. It just is horrible. And then my daughter, who's like 9 and a half, she like makes up really funny jokes all the time. And I'm like, oh, this is definitely like a skill that I don't think I have, but
The best joke I ever heard was from, this was like 20 years ago now. Our next door neighbor was a 4-year-old child, and she said, "Here's a joke. You're a flower and you're dead." That was it.
that's so poetic. I love it.
I know. I was like, yeah, that is kind of funny, I guess. It's like, it's one of those thinker type of jokes, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think like delightfully where some of the humor comes in is in sex scenes. And I'm also thinking of in The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, which has a sex scene that I think about to this day between one of the characters and her older neighbor, where at a certain point she's like aware of his penis and how big it is, and she thinks of it as a cudgel. It's like a weapon coming at her. And like her awareness is so funny, like the things that she's noticing, and even as she's like consumed with desire and he's sort of overtaking her with like power. And the opening scene that you just read to us from Mother Doll, when he's idly playing with his nipples, and then he's like fanning his erection with the sheet, like there's really funny stuff happening. What do you think about including humor in sex scenes, and why does it make it such why does it make the sex scene so good? That kind of awareness.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like sex seems like any scene that has any sort of kind of intensity, or like if you're writing it with realness, there usually is like some element of humor. I think like humor is sort of an intimacy, I guess. And if you're writing about intimacy, it sort of makes sense. It's like a shared sort of intimacy, I think. I don't know. But I guess that's not like, maybe that's not everybody's experience of sex, I guess. I don't know. I mean, that just like made me think of like someone in college who I was having sex with and who was like, "You're really like goofy." And I was like, "Oh, is that like a compliment?" And they were like, "No." And I was like, "Okay." So, it's not for everyone. I don't know. I mean, it's just like I think how I see the world, and it just applies to any part of it, you know?
I like the idea of humor as intimacy, because I think like there's humor as distance, like you were saying. There's like the like creating a safe distance from which you can experience things by using humor. But there's also humor as intimacy, because you're comfortable and you're able to be your goofy self. I was just listening to a podcast about the movie Don't Look Now, which is like an older movie with Donald Sutherland. And in that sex scene, it starts out with him having like toothpaste all over his face and daring his wife to lick it off. And then so it starts in this goofy place, and it's wonderful because it shows that they have this, they're able to be goofy and funny, but they're also, it doesn't break the moment, right? It doesn't break the intimacy. It's actually part of their intimacy.
Yeah, and I guess it could break it. It could be a way of like keeping a person apart from you or something, or breaking the moment, I guess, using humor in that sort of way. I don't know. It's so case specific, I guess.
Yeah, I think like there have been times in my life when I'm definitely not supposed to laugh, and so I laugh. And I know that's happened during during sex. But thankfully I have a partner who knows that about me and just keeps
Yeah,
me.
I feel like laughing at inappropriate moments is like, I think a really common thing that happens. Like I remember in high school, my friend and I were like watching TV at our house, and suddenly we heard this loud bang, and a car had just like crashed through the brick wall in front of our house. And like the person we so we ran outside, and like for some reason we just couldn't stop laughing at just this person, this car just standing, just being like in the middle of her front yard. And then her mother came outside and she started laughing and couldn't
Oh
stop.
my
And the
gosh.
person like got out of the car and was just like, "What the fuck?" Because they were just like in an accident. I mean, they were okay, but it was just such a like, I think a nervous reaction, I guess, or just like, I mean, it's not that we thought it was funny, but like we just could not stop laughing. Like it was like three of us just standing in the doorway, just like laughing uncontrollably
That
in
goes to
this like
like
really inappropriate way.
Yeah, well, I think that goes to kind of what you were saying, is that like humor is deeper than just something that's funny, right? Like I don't know, like there's like an ironic distance, there's a like a bewildering aspect to it, there's an intimacy, there's a closeness. So it often, like humor is more than, oh, that was funny, right? It's a lot of different things. Which I think you're so skilled at in your writing is like, using that in all of its different tools, like all the different ways that you can use it. One of the parts I laughed at immediately when I was reading this, and again as you were reading it, was the fact that she believed because it was a dollar store pregnancy test, which, first of all, as you read that, you think, okay, so there was a scene where she goes into the dollar store and buys a pregnancy test. That's hilarious on its own. And then, oh, well, it must be because it's a dollar store pregnancy test. It must be wrong. Because I had the same exact experience when my IUD failed and I was pregnant with my third daughter, my third child. I thought, oh, well, I bought the cheap version. I'll just go get the name brand and this will all be settled. And nope. It's so funny and so relatable.
It is funny, like when you see things at the dollar store that are like, functional things like that, that are like exactly, they're the same exact product. They're just
They're not name
cheaper.
brand.
But yeah.
Yes. But we have this like distrust, right? Like, oh, it's just the crappy dollar store thing.
Right.
Like I buy my kids go through bath wash and bubble bath like it's water. And so I buy it from the dollar store and I find myself thinking like, it's fine, it's just from the dollar store. It's nothing. I want to back up though and ask you where the idea for Mother Doll came from, because it is like it's a complicated structure. It's a ghost from the past speaking through a medium from today to this other character, Zhenya, who is who we met in this opening. Where that's such a like a I don't know, ambitious notion. Like, how did it come to you?
Yeah, so Zhenya gets a call out of nowhere from this like psychic medium who's channeling her great grandmother, who was a Russian revolutionary and who is like trapped in this sort of in between purgatory type space and looking for absolution, I guess, or forgiveness. And it sort of came like from a few different places, but like the main thing I think is like my grandmother left me these memoirs,
Oh my
and
God.
she had written them a long time ago. Like she learned to type specifically so she could type them up and give them to me. And I had them for years and didn't read them. And then the night of her funeral, I started reading them. And then I also started, they were in Russian, so I also started translating them because I was thinking my daughter might want to read them one day.
Oh my
And,
God.
in the process, I also started kind of like annotating them or making notes with like questions or like arguing with things she was saying. Anyway, it was like a conversation that I was having with her after she died, basically. So I think, and that's very similar to what's happening in this book. It's like a person talking to a ghost. And, the other kind of big piece from that was like, I was thinking why I had gone so long without reading them because I was close with her. I was always curious about, her life, and yet like reading them, just I felt this like strong resistance to it that I just couldn't make myself read them. And then when I finally read them, I was like, oh, I think that I felt like if I had to read them, and a lot of traumatic events happened in her life. She survived World War II. Her family was killed. Like she had to walk across Poland and like through Russia on foot, basically to like escape the war. I mean, a lot of horrible stuff happened. And I think in my head, I was thinking like, if I read her story, I will have to like be burdened with like carrying this trauma, And when I actually read it, I was like, oh, these are all things that I've felt inside of myself that I've been carrying without even having a name for them or realizing like what their source was. And so when I was able to kind of like look at them outside of myself, and kind of be able to trace some of these things, like feelings of like hypervigilance or like, just some of the ways that she writes are very similar to the way that I write. Like, even though she wasn't a writer, but like she would just have these like pretty innocuous encounters that she would write about, and they would just be like suddenly full of like dread and fear for no real reason, And it was like she was projecting from these traumatic events that happened to her, which she does like recount also, like pretty like matter-of-factly. it's like that stuff is getting projected onto other stuff in her life, you know, like, and so I mean, there's just like a lot of things that I could sort of trace, because like I think in my writing, like one of the things I often notice is there's like these details that feel suddenly kind of like alarming, but like nothing actually alarming is happening. You know, it's like living in a state of just like high anxiety, which I mean, I think a lot of people do. But yeah, I don't know, like seeing her story and kind of seeing it in myself made me also kind of think about like what's mine, what's been given to me, what is like actually mine, what do I want to keep, what do I not want to keep, like those types of questions, which also like having a child made me think about all of that too, like what am I passing down to her, what has been passed down to me kind of stuff. So I think like those are all things that I was like thinking about and wanted to explore, and like I don't know, like I also knew that I kind of wanted to write about the Russian Revolution, but I wasn't entirely sure like what the entry point would be. And I also knew I wanted to like write a multi-generational saga, but I wanted it to feel like not like LA, but like New York in the sense of like not sprawled, but like all stacked inside of like one person, because that's I think kind of how I experience time, and I think that's like also how we carry our generate, you know, like all of the past exists inside of us, you know.
I really love how you just said, not like LA, but like New York, because Janya lives in LA, right? Like,
She does.
that's such a great way to think about it. I mean, I guess I would think about it because I grew up in Orlando, which is like LA, it's sprawl, and I live in Chicago, which is like New York. So, but I think it's so interesting also what you said about you wanted it to feel like New York in that it was stacked because that's how you experience time. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, like I was thinking a lot. So I wrote the pandemic during, I mean, sorry, I wrote the book during the pandemic where like time was so strange, I think for everybody, you know, it was this total break from normal life, normal routines. And time also, I feel like, is strange when you have a small child because it's both like endless and very fast. It's like, yeah, just time like never entirely like makes sense to me. It just doesn't like I don't have really like the kind of internal clock that I think some people must have where they can like know how much time has passed or things like that. I don't know, like I just always think about that. And also I think about like I think I was like kind of getting into I'm trying to think of who it was. It was like meditation stuff and this idea of like, you know, time only existing in the present moment. Like that kind of stuff, like that time only exists now, you know, like there is no actual past and there's no actual future. It's just like a constant state of present or whatever. So I remember like when I first heard that, that kind of blew my mind a little bit.
I think that's so true for how I started experiencing time after I became a mom. But then again, it could be like after I became 40, you know, like I feel like it really is like time is a collage of all time. So then it's only now because you're experiencing it, you're remembering it, you're calling it, you know, calling it back to you, you're thinking about the future, you're thinking, I think about my mother as a child, I think about her mother as a child, I think about my childhood, you know, like it's all in every like bit of awareness of my day, you know, and I feel like that really became true for me only after I started watching my kids grow up and experience the world for the first time, and kind of thinking like, what do they already have because it was part of me, you know, what are they taking with them?
Yeah, like for me, seeing my daughter at the ages that I was at when certain like events in my life happened brought those events back to me. Like I immigrated to the US when I was 3 and a half, so it's not really like a time period I really remember or like thought about that much growing up, but seeing her at those ages, like at that age and then kind of later, it really just made me think about all those things, like the experiences I was having at those ages too. And like in LA, where time passes really Weirdly, because there aren't like seasonal, I mean, there are seasons, but they're not like the same kind of. I'm from the Northeast, so like the seasonal markers that I had relied on to like mark time aren't really there. And it just feels like, that sort of sense of like time, so much time passing, and you don't really know like what happened to it. But then like having a child makes it actually very easy to see time passing, because they're like that ex it's like an external clock.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting because I can remember like growing up in Orlando where it's like LA, where it's the same season. And if you get like a 60 degree day, you get all excited to bust out your sweater or put pants on, you know? Like, but it does feel like you're just constantly in this like flat sprawl of time. And then I moved to Chicago and I was like, oh, like these feelings I used to feel. When, technically it was spring, but it was still 80 degrees in Florida. Like, those are related to the equinox or whatever, like those are related to the light changing. And, like it makes your body sort of like understands the seasons in this way that when you're not experiencing them can feel like, wait, what, where am I in time? Like, what am I doing? Like we need those
Yeah.
things.
It makes me think of like the, I think, was it Peter Pan with like the lost boys that just like disappear and like everybody ages and they like kind of stay like
Yes.
suspended in time? 'Cause that is kind of in some ways how it feels. I mean, yeah, I feel like there's a lot of like in the book of the sense where she's like, my life is gonna start at some point in the future,
Yes.
And I think it's easy to feel that way in places. Probably like Orlando or LA, where like there's no kind of sense of like these discrete sort of seasons of like now we're here, now we're here, now we're here, It's just
Yeah,
so continuous.
I'm glad you brought that up with Xenia because she is sort of letting life happen to her. And in some ways, she's consciously doing that, right? Like she is consciously not going to go visit her grandmother. Even though we know her grandmother said, please don't visit me, don't see me like this. Xenia knows and we know she should, right? She's like kind of not making a decision about the baby. She's letting that kind of happen to her. And she's just sort of like even Paul has to force her to listen to the calls with her grandmother, I'm sorry, her great grandmother. And at the end we sort of see her like have agency, right? Like she's sort of comes into like a like she's crafting this life that works for her that doesn't look like what maybe someone who would, that maybe she would expect to have a partner and raise the baby together, but her life looks different than that, and she's happy that way. Can you talk a little bit about that evolution?
Yeah, like I knew one of the things I really wanted was to have Xenia have like a real arc, like a coming of age type of like her becoming, not like becoming an adult as if that's like a destination that you just land at, but
Right.
like she's really going from feeling very stuck, feeling like she has no agency, feeling very passive in her life, and like just also not really having any like accountability or taking responsibility for choices she does make, because she just doesn't feel like any of them matter. Like she feels like, well, nothing I do could hurt anyone, like, because I'm just like, it's insignificant, because what, I don't matter, And going from that to like, she does, I think, actually make the decision to have a baby. And then that really like kind of begins the process of her like growing up, I guess, or getting in touch with like what it is exactly she desires, even though like the pregnancy was not a choice, it was just an accident. She like her decision to keep it as a choice. And it does like blow up her marriage, and it's like a big choice. But I think like her processing her great grandmother's story and like really kind of looking at this kind of ancestral trauma, or this past that has been like sort of handed to her, that she's been living with without really like looking at or understanding, is what allows her to like make that shift and feel more connected to herself. And as a result, to like her desire, to what she wants. 'Cause you're right, like at the end of the book, she's living the life that she wants to be living, even if, like, from the outside, like to her mother, for example, it looks like not very sustainable or tenable, you know?
It made me think a lot about what you're saying about the collective, because you're talking about collective trauma and how that affects, people in the present, the baby that's going to come, like the way that we think about the past, but also the collective that she forms with Chloe and Anton, where they're very, easy with each other. They help each other. They love each other. They might even begin to make love to each other. And at a certain point, Zhenya nurses Chloe's baby. And I just thought it was a beautiful, sorry, I thought it was a beautiful rendering of, we always talk about how, oh, it takes a village, and it really does take a village. And the village that Zhenya creates is something that helps her, like with these very practical things, helps her be less lonely. It helps her literally have someone else keep eyes on her baby while she's showering or whatever it is. But it also helps heal, right? Like she's receiving this kind of love and giving this kind of love that she has needed. And there's a beautiful, spoiler alert, but the way that she gets her great grandmother to leave her alone is she nurses her in this vision, and then her great grandmother's able to go, right, to leave. And I just thought, what a beautiful way of saying something about the collective, right?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I thought of that scene as like very, as just this like catharsis, you know? Yeah, and I think like the ending is just, it's like, it's both really beautiful and very like unstable in some ways because, you know, she at some point says something like, she's very close with her friend and she's sleeping with her friend's husband, and she doesn't really know if her friend fully knows this or not. And, you know, I think that she's like, I don't know, I guess I'm giving away a lot of stuff, but yeah, I think it's like a complicated situation because she doesn't know like how much her friend knows, and she doesn't want to, she's scared to be honest because then it might, you know, all of this could just disappear and she doesn't want it to. But at the same time, you know, like, are they in a shared reality or not is kind of like a question that she has. Like, does her friend know and is she okay with this? Which it seems like likely is the case, but she doesn't know this for sure. They don't talk about it directly. And so I feel like it's one of those things where she's like changing, you know, like she's growing up and coming into contact with these aspects of herself, but it's not like she's fully there or something, you know, like this could all very well just really blow up in her face like several pages after the book is over, you know, or it could be like a sustained thing and it's not really entirely clear, it's ambiguous, but while it is happening, it's definitely like very beautiful.
Let's talk about ambiguous endings, because in Deeper the Water, someone comes to the door, and we don't know exactly who comes to the door. The sisters are back together. If you haven't read it, people who are listening, please do. It is just such an amazing novel. But yeah, so that we don't know for sure who comes to the door. We have a guess, right? And we think it might be the mother. But we don't know how that's going to affect the sisters. And it, same as what you're saying about Mother Doll is, like this could all blow up, or Chloe knows about it and it's actually helping her too, and she's fine with it. And even so, that could still blow up in a year, right? Because those
Yeah.
relationships are complicated. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to ambiguous endings? Is that something you love when you're reading?
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, so in my first book, The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, the ending is like these sisters who are, well, I don't, I guess I'm like giving away endings to everything now, but these sisters are adults now, and I think the ending is really about like there, it's like that experience of constantly waiting for her mother to show up. You know, like you feel it, whether it, you know, it's not like so much about whether she literally does or not, but like it's that constant feeling of like anticipation that she's just like left with forever, you know, like that's never gonna go away. Even though she's an adult and like has this life, like she's always gonna be waiting for her mother. And it, I don't know how I feel about like ambiguous endings in general. Like I think sometimes I guess they could be unsatisfying. But I feel like it's more like I more think about like what feeling do I want to leave to be left with or to leave someone with, you know? Like not necessarily like whether the events kind of wrap up. 'Cause like life doesn't really wrap up. It continues like outside. You know, you can imagine these characters, you know, they're where you decide to kind of end the story is sort of gonna, you know, whether it's you're giving something like a quote unquote happy ending, or if you know, wait 2 more years and give it a sad ending, you know, like, 'cause life continues on past whatever you decide is like kind of the frame of the story. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think like a lot more in terms of just like the emotions. And the kind of like experience, I like to make readers uncomfortable. I think it's fun. So yeah, I guess an ambiguity, I think, is one is like very uncomfortable. I think people hate ambiguity. They want clarity all the time. I mean, I want clarity all the time. Ambiguity is so hard to sit inside of.
But that's life. It's like you're saying, there's not often something that we can just, okay, that's how I feel about that, and the door is closed, we're done. I love novels that have, quote unquote ambiguous endings, because even if I'm not satisfied, even if I'm uncomfortable, I'm still puzzling it out, right? Like I'm still trying to figure it out and figure out how I feel about it, and that changes often. Or like another bit of information enters my world, and I'm like, oh, okay, I can kind of see this thing that has been bugging me. I can see it in a whole new way. And that's where I really think it's successful, is that it's, the book, the people in the book, the notions, the ideas, they live on because you're still thinking about them. I think that's really valuable. But I do think you're right. There's a large cache of readers who really just want to put the book down and know, okay, there were these three questions and they each had three answers. Like they each had an answer, right? Like, and that's that, and I don't have to think about that ever again, right?
Yeah, I feel like readers sometimes want like a lot of clarity. I mean, I think like having a very clear ending means also you're like, I'm done with the book. You know, like I don't have to ever think about it again. And it's sort of a little bit of like a trick to have it ambiguous because then you're like stuck thinking about it forever, you know, in some ways. You know, you want to get under people's skin, I guess. And I think also the other thing in terms of ambiguity, not about endings, but like with characters, I think a lot of times people are like, oh, this character is doing something that's like morally that I disagree with. Like, I want you, the author, to make it really clear that you personally also disagree with it and that they're bad, you know? And it's like, especially like with my first book, where there were characters who were doing like really not, you know, like actually terrible things. There was like people, some people like wanted me to just like say that, you know? And it's like, well, I think that's pretty clear, you know? But I think, yeah, I think sometimes that bothers people if you're not like making a moral judgment at all times on your characters when they do things that are not good.
I have a story called Food Luck, and it's first person like rant about this really sad dude's life. And he's like a competitive eater. And at some point, he yells a derogatory term for a gay man at his father. And it's part of his rage, it's part of his vernacular as the character that he is. But every once in a while, and this story is so old, I don't know, but I just torture myself thinking, like, oh, will someone read that story and think that I'm the kind of person that would ever say that? But I have to remind myself my intention, like, there's, because there is this conversation always happening about, like, people's, artists' duty toward, I don't know, injustice, right? Like you can expose it, but you also have to, have a disclaimer in there or something, or a trigger warning. And I think I reject that, I guess. I think like you can let it be in the world of the character. And I think especially in Deeper the Water, Uglier the Fish, the not to spoil it, although we have spoiled some things, the father character is extremely inappropriate in a lot of ways. And we know that, right? But it there that's the discomfort you're talking about, is that the you are never breaking in, and there's no author's note saying like, I strongly disagree with the actions of the father and this is wrong. And and people, they want the kind of satisfaction, they want the kind of moral righteousness that doesn't lead to discomfort, right?
Yeah, and I think there's also probably this like confusion around like fiction versus, I think people are like, well, why would you write something that you didn't experience directly?
Oh my
You
God.
know, like it's just very like, I don't write autobiographical fiction, like it just isn't something I'm interested in. But I think like, I think that's hard for some people to understand. I don't know. Like, I think some people maybe are very like literal about that stuff. They're like, if you wrote about this, that means you did this.
Or
And
you
it's like,
experienced it. I think that's
yeah.
true, like especially for women. I think, female writers are often kind of interrogated, like, oh, is this how your actual marriage is? Or, like, is this like, was your mother like this to you? And it's like, I'm writing a novel. I'm writing something completely made up, that resembles real life. But, and I think, I don't know. I think that's something that we have to fight all the time. Of just like, these are fictional people and these are real issues that I'm examining and important things, but not necessarily anything that happened to me. And that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always like some sort of seed of something, like
Yeah.
there's a reason that this story is of interest to me, but it's not for me like a literal, I think I have a lot more freedom if I'm writing about characters who are very different from myself. It just gives me like a lot more space to like explore ideas or feelings. And it's like those feelings, like I've felt the same things my characters have felt. That the reasons they felt that way and I felt that way are very different. But like, there's like emotional truth in my books that I'm drawing on, but that's not the same thing as like the logistical, practical, like factual truth,
I think that's such a good way of putting it, drawing on emotional truth versus like, here is exactly what happened in my childhood. Enjoy. You are great at like the polyvocal novel. You love to write in, different voices. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so with my first book, it's like multiple first person narrators. And I had written only short stories beforehand. So I think my fear was like, I wouldn't be able to maintain a voice for like over the course of an entire novel or something like that. Like it just seemed like, oh, this is kind of a way to make it a little less intimidating for me if I think of it as like almost modular or like, made of these pieces, then I'm not thinking of it as like one enormous block that like just seems overwhelmingly difficult to, penetrate. So I think that was kind of where it started with the first book. With this book, I was like, I want to write a third person omniscient book. Partly it was like a tip of my hat or whatever to like Russian 19th century novels. Partly it was like, I want to write about these people. I mean, I want to write about multiple characters. There, I guess Irina, who is like telling her story, is telling her story. So that part is like in first person, but it's like being channeled through the medium. But like, I really wanted to write about like blind spots, in a lot of ways. And I wanted to write about like emotional, like when I think of Irina's character, she's like a part of a person that was like repressed, not dealt with, not integrated into the rest of them. Like, this is just her shame, like that existed from when she was a teenager. She continued her life and had this like whole very long life after. But this part of herself is something she like kept secret. She never had any like compassion for or like told anyone about, And so it like kind of continued to live on in this parallel kind of world, this afterlife type of place. So I was just thinking about like, oh, I want to have a character who's like not in touch with their emotions, but has very strong emotions. And I want like that feeling, that like intensity to come across without coming. Like, I don't know, it was like a weird balance. It was like the image that I kept thinking of was like you're looking at the ocean and you can like feel stuff like fish or sharks or something, like you could feel stuff moving under the surface of it, but like you don't see it really breaking the surface except for like maybe in like small glimmers here and there. But you're like aware of stuff kind of moving under the surface. And so I was like trying to figure out a way to have that in this book to like communicate like that kind of emotionality while also being like very kind of like dead faced at the same time. And so, yeah, I kind of like arrived at this sort of structure and this voice and this point of view. But generally, like, I'm always really interested in this idea of like people having completely different experiences from the same experiences, just like people's different perceptions of reality is always like something that I'm interested in. Like in my first book, it's like two sisters who are in the same family, but they have really different like experiences of their parents. And here, it's also like with Zhenya, and then at the end with her friend, like, are they in a shared experience or not? And it's like, part of her story is like her trying to understand, like, the world around herself and her place in it and other people's perception of it and like trying to bridge that sort of gap.
I love that. I think that's absolutely what is happening here, right? Like it's I can't say it any better than what you just said. It's so good. Because that's one of the things that I love so much about The Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish is that like we're getting these two perspectives, but we're also getting them in two different times because we're getting them in present tense and then we're also getting them looking back. And so like that changes too. Like looking back on something in memory changes it, even though we can trust that voice, we can trust what they're saying. But you're playing with perception on every level there, on what we're perceiving in the moment, and then what we can call back from a later time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about just like memory a lot. And in this book too, I think about that with Zhenya and her mother, like their understanding of like Zhenya's childhood is different. And their understanding of Vera, Zhenya's grandmother, is different. Because like Vera as a grandmother was one way, but as a mother was very different. She wasn't like the kind of nurturing, warm presence that Zhenya knows her as being. She was like complicated and cold
Jealous.
and like jealous and like, yeah, difficult. She hadn't wanted to have a child. It was like a she'd grown up in an orphanage, like it was a lot. And even though she was able to be this very giving and warm grandmother, like she even as Mydina became an adult, her daughter, they had a complicated relationship. And so as a result, Zhenya, in this like triangle of a relationship, was sort of forced to choose between her grandmother and her mother, like in terms of her like allegiances, in terms of like whose reality and sense of the world is she gonna like align with. And she picked her grandmother, and her mother was kind of shut out in some ways. And her mother also like had another child with her husband, with her like American husband. So Zhenya has like a younger brother, and like they kind of have this sort of other family, even though they all live like in the same house. But it's sort of like a complicated dynamic. And then after the grandmother dies, like Zhenya and her mother, their relationship starts to shift too, because like in that triangle, like once Vera is no longer part of their dynamic, their relationship can really evolve and change because she was kind of keeping it in place in a very specific way. So, yeah, I mean, I think with this book, I was really interested in like showing changes over time and growth, you know? So I think like having a polyphonic type of, I mean, it's not really like polyphonic in the same way that my first book is, but having that sort of, it's not like a first person narrator, it's like a shifting third person narrator. So it is like, it just gives me a lot more space, I think, to explore all of that stuff and show it changing over time.
Speaking of changing over time, in my discussion with Brandi Wells last week, I asked them something that led to them describing how watching the Muppet Babies as a child was how they came to love the notion of a character crafting and then inhabiting their own world. And I want to ask you the same thing. What was your awakening, let's call it, into the notion that writing was for you, that you were going to write?
Well, I didn't really want to become a writer until like halfway through college. Like, I didn't grow up wanting to be a writer. I grew up doing a lot of like various artistic and creative projects, but most of them were visual. And I was like interested in like directing and I was interested in like photography, but like my photographs were kind of like felt sort of like movie stills. So like I don't know. I think like when I was in college, my neighbor, shout out to Matt Grice, he was a really talented writer and still is. And he was taking like a writing workshop and just encouraged me to take one with him. And I was sort of like struggling with photography at the time. And so I was like, okay, I'll just try it. And then it ended up being this really a fun experience. And then I also was like, oh, I can basically like the sort of narrative stuff that I really wanted to be doing, I can like do this more easily with words than with images. Like not more easily in terms of like my goal, but just like practically. Like I didn't need other people, I didn't need equipment, I didn't need to be like in the dark room for hours. I could just kind of create it myself. And that was like pretty empowering. And so I was like writing these prose poems. I guess that was my kind of first entry into writing. And like reading these prose poems by like Charles Simic, James Tate, the New York School poets, I was just so into them. And it was like, oh, they can just kind of create this mood or this feeling in me. In like just such a short little space with just these like specific weird details. And so I guess that was sort of like the entry point for me into writing.
Creating a feeling with specific weird details is exactly what you do, Katya. You're very, very good at that, and you're very, very good at it in Mother Doll, which is your new novel, coming out, what, next week?
March 12th.
March 12th. Okay. It's out on March 12th, which I believe is today, that in podcast
Okay.
time. Thank you so much for coming on. This was such a pleasure. I love your writing. I can't wait for everyone to read this new one.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the show.